Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette on this Wednesday, November the 20th, 2024. Today on the front page is a picture of a young man with the title Turning the Page. A graduate looking forward to writing and having more time with family. By Luke Taylor. If he hadn't gotten sober in order to attend Champaign County Drug Court, James Southward believes he wouldn't be here today. I'm in drug court. I'm into the program. I'm really learning stuff. And what does God hit me with? I had lymph node cancer, Southward said. I'm like, come on, God. I'm trying. Southward hadn't thought of himself as an alcoholic in the traditional sense until one night he got stupid and crashed his car into a tree while driving under the influence. He wouldn't drink every day, but whenever he had free time, Southward would start drinking with the intention of getting drunk until he had something to do again. That's part of why his cancer diagnosis was such a concern for maintaining sobriety. He had to stop work for a while to recover, and suddenly he had a lot of free time. Even though it wasn't an everyday thing, it was still controlling my life, Southward said. He said that people in his life began to distance themselves because he was drunk so much, which led to a cycle of drinking even more as he didn't realize the problem was with him. Southward said that he'd been drinking since he was young because that's what he had always seen the grown-ups do. It started with stealing small amounts of alcohol after parties and led to a serious problem as an adult. If he found himself missing out on spending time with his family and not making much art, something he really enjoys. He noticed it. Wanting to start out on the right foot, Southward sobered up before his first Champaign County Drug Court meeting, and after 18 months he graduated on Monday. Doing the program, I'm not going to say it's easy because it's the easier part of the recovery process because you have people on your back, Southward said. But Southward is hard-headed, he said, and was confident that he could be exposed to situations with alcohol without being tempted. Besides, he doesn't expect to have too much free time anymore. I've got all this stuff that I want to do now that I'm not thinking about drinking, Southward said. He's writing a book. For one, a memoir he hopes gives direction to others in similar situations not to make the same mistakes he did. He's also restarting saxophone lessons, and he hopes spending more time with family. I'm a young boy from the west side of Chicago, so I was an aspiring rapper. But getting older now, it's more, yeah, the words rhyme, but what are you saying? Southward said he was trying to be a rapper when he was a poet and just didn't know it. That's what my mom said. At the top of the front page, an article about Willard Airport by Jana Wiersema, entitled Input Sought on Three Major Renovation Projects. The University of Illinois Willard Airport is asking the community for its thoughts on three projects that are estimated to total $8.5 million altogether, including renovations that Executive Director Tim Bannon said will extend the useful life of the terminal building. The airport has posted information about the projects, along with a link to provide comments at ificu.com/public comment. These documents will be available for public comment through December 17th. The Federal Aviation Administration requires airports to offer opportunities for public comment on projects that may interrupt normal operations, Bannon said. There are three that sees as meeting this criteria. One of these projects, the largest, is planned rehabilitation of the terminal building, originally built in the late 1980s. We're going to get done about as much as we can within a $6.5 million total budget, Bannon said. We're going through consultant selection right now, working with the university to select a professional service consultant so that we can get into scope development and design. The project is expected to include the following elements: replacement of two roof sections, replacement of two escalators, refurbishment of two elevators, evaluation and potential replacement of the main terminal lobby revolving doors, skylight, and windows, replacement of the exterior finishing system of the building. It's estimated that the project would be designed in 2026 and completed in 2027. According to Bannon, funding will come from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, the Illinois Department of Transportation, and airport matching funds. Perhaps one of the most anticipated improvements to the terminal building is the new escalators, as only one of the two is currently in service. With the amount of money we're invested in the down escalator, we probably could have just replaced it by now, Bannon said. He said that the airport has been dealing with a lot of different issues with the down escalator for multiple years, and repairs have not always gone well. For instance, the refurbished gearbox was installed as part of the recent repairs. However, after the escalator had been in operation for a couple of days, some oil presented itself on the steps, causing the airport to shut it down proactively, Bannon said. He was unable to give a timeline for the current repairs, but said their contractor is working with the machine shop that refurbished the gearbox to evaluate the problem. These escalators are original to the building from 1988, so we had step replacement, he told News Gazette. We've had the handrail replacement, the bull gear, and now the main gearbox that is kind of the transmission of the escalator. So we've made a lot of investment in that down escalator and attempts to get it back up and running again. The other two projects on Willard's to-do list are an estimated $1.5 million effort to repair and replace concrete and asphalt sections of the general aviation aprons and a $500,000 asphalt paving project for the employee parking lot and the entrance road to the lot, which also serves as secondary entrance to the terminal loop road, Bannon said. Both projects will be funded using state and local funds only, he said. This includes a $1.5 million grant from IDOT for the apron work and Rebuild Illinois funding for the road work. It's estimated that the road work could start in the spring of 2025 and the apron work could start in spring or summer. Bannon said that while the bids on the road paving came back favorably, the bids on the apron work were a little bit high. We're working with IDOT to evaluate those bids and determine if we're able to award, he said, noting that the start date may be pushed to summer if they have to rebid the project. He added that both of these smaller projects are expected to have relatively minimal effects on airport operations, with the terminal likely to have more of an impact. And there's diagrams for the proposed work on Willard Airport, general aviation aprons, and the employee lot and entrance roads. The last remaining article on the front page has the title, Defendant's Mother, Aunt Both Testify, 2022 Murder Trial Day 2. Both say they saw fellow passenger wearing fanny pack watching gun videos by Luke Taylor. Evidence presented on the second day of the trial for a Champaign man accused of fatally shooting a Lyft driver in 2022 began to center around a disagreement over the existence of a fanny pack and whether it contained a gun. On Monday, the first day of Tyjon Williams' bench trial on murder charges in the death of Christian Philpotts, a fellow passenger in the vehicle, Nashawn Fenderson, testified that not only had he never owned a fanny pack, he had never worn one. Fenderson and another passenger, Jaheim Dyer, were both initially also charged with murder, but pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice and agreed to testify against Williams. Williams' lawyer, Stephen Kami of Chicago, described the case as a whodunit with three possible suspects. The trial was originally only scheduled for Monday and Tuesday, but will extend into Wednesday with one to two more witnesses yet to take the stand. Fenderson's apparent nervous behavior and hesitance to answer questions were both remarked upon throughout his testimony on Monday, but he was very clear about denying ownership of a fanny pack. On Tuesday, Williams' mother and aunt both testified that Fenderson, who lived with them for some time, wore a fanny pack all the time. The mother said he wore it as a cross baddie bag, while the aunt said he wore it around his waist. Both described it as typically containing something heavy, but unidentified. On the night of the shooting, William's mother said that when she saw the three 17-year-olds getting into the lift, she ordered for them. Fenderson was wearing the fanny pack and a yellow puffy jacket that was memorable because it was bright. Commie brought Fenderson in to testify a second time on Tuesday. During his cross-examination, Larson presented stills from body camera footage captured by Urbana police officer Cortez Gardner when he briefly spoke to Fenderson a couple of hours after the shooting. No fanny pack or yellow jacket was visible. Fenderson was wearing a Puma brand sweatshirt. Larson asked William's mother if she was trying to imply that Fenderson carried a gun in the fanny pack, and she answered that she still did not know what was in the bag. William's mother said that she had initially been planning to drop him off at his hair appointment on the way to a different event with her other children. When Fenderson and Dyer asked to go along, she realized she didn't have room in her vehicle, and she ordered the lift so that they could. After she arrived at Skateland with the other kids and her sister, William's mother said she received a call from him letting her know that his hair appointment had been canceled because he was running late. Text messages obtained by Urbana police from the cell phone Williams was using showed that the appointment originally scheduled for 5:40 p.m. on January 12, 2022, had been moved back to 6 p.m. by the hairdresser. When Williams texted that he was on the way at 5:59 p.m., the hairdresser said she was also on the way, and at 6:17 p.m. she said she was putting groceries away and ready for him. No text message presented to the court implied the appointment was canceled. On the phone call, William's mother said she told her son she wouldn't have time to pick him up, but would instead use the Lyft app to reroute the ride back home. Then he said, oh, no, Mom, and the phone went dead, she said. Both the mother and aunt said that they would be surprised to see Williams with a gun, but that Fenderson frequently watched YouTube videos about guns, including tutorials. The aunt also described seeing Fenderson with a gun before. Prosecutors said Snapchat messages obtained from Williams' cell phone implied that he was attempting to attain a firearm. Around 6 days prior to the shooting, photos captured the day before the shooting appeared to show him holding a firearm. Forensic pathologist Shipping Bao also testified Tuesday and explained that photos from the autopsy he performed on Mr. Philpotts. Bao confirmed the cause of death to be a single gunshot wound that entered through his right upper back and traveled down and forward, perforating his lungs and heart. Moving on to our communities, at the top of the page, an article with the heading Canadian National Railroad. Champagne man cited after report of weapon pointed at train by Luke Taylor. A Champagne man has been issued a notice to appear by police after Canadian National Railway employees said they believed he pointed a weapon at a train as it passed by. Champaign police received a report from railroad staff early on the morning of November 12th of multiple incidents in recent weeks in which projectiles struck windows on trains traveling the east-west rail lines near Spalding Park. Officers responded to the area near Beardsley and Harris Avenues to investigate and provide a visible presence as a train crossed through the area. As a train moved through at 6:44 a.m., railroad employees reported seeing an armed suspect pointing what appeared to be a firearm in their direction. Champaign police returned to the area and spoke with employees before making contact at a home in the 600 block of West Beardsley. Police found a pellet gun in the residence that matched the description of the weapon seen by railroad employees. They spoke with the resident, 20-year-old Trey Keith, and issued him a notice to appear on charges of criminal damage. The investigation is ongoing despite the citation being issued. Also on the page under our communities, a picture with the heading, You Can Ring Their Bells. A picture of two men standing by a Salvation Army kettle. Prairie Garden CEO Jeff Wandell left and Salvation Army of Champaign County Captain Kenyon Civils helped launch the agency's annual Red Kettle Christmas campaign with a bell-ringing ceremony Tuesday at Prairie Gardens in Champaign. The nonprofit is seeking volunteer bell ringers for 21 kettles at retailers in Champaign, Mahomet, Rantoul, Savoy, St. Joseph, and Urbana through December 23rd. Volunteers can sign up at registering.com or by emailing erin.bird@usc.salvationarmy.org. Another article from St. Joseph Community Center with the heading Foundation Board Focusing on Fundraising by Dave Hinton. A Recreation Foundation Board formed to build a community center in St. Joseph has finished a feasibility study and will now focus on raising funds. Board member Todd Hitt said the study was necessary prior to applying for state and federal grant money. We'll be moving into the fundraising position next to turn dirt by May of 2026, Hitt said. He said the model being used by the board involves a public-private partnership. The community center will be built on a 5-acre plot owned by the village beside the Woodard Sports Complex east of St. Joseph. The Ralph Woodard family, through the Ralph Foundation, has donated $1.2 million toward what is considered a $4 million project in exchange for naming rights of the community building. Village Administrator Joe Hackney said St. Joseph will also contribute $300,000 that it made from the state of a donated downtown building. The village was donated a building by the Woodard family, and the village decided not to make it a community building, Hackney said. It didn't meet the needs of a community building. The building now houses the Gallo Dance Studio. For the Recreation Foundation Board, the process so far has included securing tax-exempt status, insurance, and the feasibility study. The board hired an architect for building design. We wanted to stay more on the frugal side, Hitt said, with the realization that once the building is constructed, it has to be maintained and rented out to make it economically feasible. We're going to go with user fees to maintain the operational costs, Hitt said. As part of the generating money to build the center, Hitt said the board will hold a Queen of Hearts fundraising game. It will also seek business development grants and an open space lands acquisition and development grant from the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Hitt said the village used open space grant money to buy the land 20 years ago. Sponsorship will also be used to raise money. Different sections of the facility will be named for sponsors, including the outdoor patio, bar, kitchen, event space, and foyer areas. All have dollar amounts assigned to them for large donations, Hitt said. The event space, not including bar, kitchen, and storage, will encompass 5,000 square feet and can hold up to 350 people. Also connected to that article, an article with the title, Tolono Seeks Input on Building Facility of Its Own, by Dave Hinton. Village board members want to get residents' input on whether a community center should be built. Village President Rob Murphy said the board initially planned to renovate the village's downtown using some of the money it received when Illinois American Water bought Tolono's water and sewer system, but quashed those plans due to public comment. They didn't like our plan, Murphy said, so we didn't vote for it or to go out for a bid. So some kind of scrapped the downtown plan. Board member Vicki Buffo suggested that the village consider a community center. The board decided it wanted to hear what the public thought of the idea. Murphy said the village won't put any money into a community center proposal until exploring the options, especially community input. We've talked about where we'd put it, possibly where the village hall is now or in a central location, Murphy said. We haven't talked about building size, what it would encompass, or the cost. Murphy said the village doesn't have an adequate meeting place for larger gatherings. He said he's intrigued by the plans in St. Joseph, where a community center will be built at the Woodard Sports Complex east of town. Private donations will fund much of that cost. In Tolono, Clerk Treasurer Brandy Dalton said the village was $9.9 million from the sale of its water and sewer systems. Let's hear from J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History. an unintended victim of the Kennedy assassination. The yellow taxi pulled up to a sidewalk in downtown Milwaukee. It was Friday afternoon, the weekend before Thanksgiving, and traffic was brisk. A 27-year-old man hopped inside. As he sped off, the cabbie asked, "Did you hear about Kennedy in Dallas?" Thinking it was the start of a new joke, the young man eagerly leaned forward and grinned, "No, I haven't. How does it go?" What followed wasn't funny. The president had been assassinated in Dallas, and while it was a tragedy for the nation, it was a personal blow to that young man in Milwaukee. When November 22nd dawned, the cabbie's passenger was famous. He went to bed that night as a has-been. Vaughn Meter was born in 1936 to a working-class family in Maine. When he was a toddler, his father broke his neck and drowned in a diving accident. His widowed mother took a job as a cocktail waitress in Boston, leaving the child with relatives. Perhaps not surprisingly, Meter was a troubled kid. Unruly at times, he was shuttled between his mother, who was sinking into alcoholism, and various children's homes. He also enjoyed the limelight. He did a stint in the Army after high school. Stationed in West Germany in the late 1950s, he formed a GI country music group, with him also doing impressions of famous singers. Meter married a German woman, returned stateside, and plowed into the entertainment field in New York. His comedy act features a spot-on imitation of President John F. Kennedy, who was just taking the national stage. Handsome and with similar features, he copied Kennedy's mannerisms and even resembled him a little. Audience loved it. When JFK moved into the White House, Meter found his calling. He made history on October 22, 1962, when he and a small cast recorded The First Family. The album charted new territory by gently parodying the Kennedy family. There had never been anything like it before. Saturday Night Live was still 13 years away. The recording was an overnight smash hit, selling 1.2 million copies in just the first 2 weeks. Sales eventually totaled 7.5 LPs a record, until the Beatles came along and obliterated it. Kennedy incidentally relished the attention the hit record unexpectedly brought him. Asked at a presidential news conference if he'd heard it, JFK said he had, adding, "I thought it sounded more like Teddy than me." He gave the album to his close friends that Christmas and even quipped at a Democratic Party gathering, "Vaughn Meter was busy tonight, so I came myself." Overnight, Vaughn found himself the second most famous man in the country. According to one newspaper, he was the toast of the entertainment world, appearing on era's biggest TV shows, Ed Sullivan, Jack Parr, Andy Williams, To Tell the Truth, and What's My Line, among them. Frank Sinatra even invited him to join the Rat Pack. These were the glory days for Meter. Then Kennedy went to Dallas. Iconoclastic comic Lenny Bruce didn't let the assassination keep him off stage. On the night of November 22nd, he walked up to the microphone, was silent for a long stretch, and then finally said, "Boy, Vaughn Meter is totally screwed." Bruce was right. All TV appearances and concerts were canceled. Though Meter was already working on a second non-Kennedy album, it was instantly shelved. In the profound national grief following the murder, Americans didn't want to hear from a comedian who reminded them of their lost leader. That's when Meter's life hit the skids. The new album, Have Some Nuts, bombed when it came out in 1964. Depression set in. His drinking was out of control. His wife left him. He slept around and turned to drugs, which progressively grew harder. The few times he could land gigs, fellow comedians described him as insufferable. There were three more marriages. He lost himself in religion. He made another album, this one called The Second Coming, about Jesus Christ returning to earth in the days of Jesus Christ Superstar. Sales were again in the cellar. By the 1970s, he was living in his final wife's hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, playing piano and singing as Abbott Meter, his first name, hustling, any honky-tonk date he could rustle up. He also dabbled in bluegrass music back in his native Maine, but it was nickel-and-dime stuff, and he existed on the financial edge. Meter made a few late-life cameo performances, including the 1976 film Linda Lovelace for President, and even had a tiny spot on the 1981 comedy album lampooning Ronald Reagan called The First Family Rides Again, featuring Rich Little. It was a modest success, but nothing spectacular like the original. By the end, Meter was barely able to breathe as he battled chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. He was toothless, bearded, and still angling for a comeback right up until he died at the age of 68 in 2004. Despite being little more than the answer to trivia questions today, he had been a pioneer. He paved the way for little SNL and a wide range. He paved the way for little SNL and a wide range of presidential impressionists. They all owe their success to Vaughn Meter, the comedy trailblazer who lost it all in an instant one November afternoon. And another local article by Dave Hinton about Mohammed Seymour School Board. Back to the drawing board. Options weighed after voters again reject facilities plan. A double shift school, additional portable classrooms, and even another property tax hike referendum were among discussion points Monday as Mohammed Seymour School Board members brainstormed potential ways to alleviate school overcrowding. The board has been through this before, asking, what do we do now, after voters on November 5th rejected a property tax increase for the third time. It sought $112.8 million to build a new junior high school and new second and third grade building and renovate Lincoln Trail Elementary School. Weighing other options in the wake of that proposal's defeat, Superintendent Kenny Lee asked, it is portables. Is it mobile carts? Is it increased class size? Mobile carts are used in a system in which teachers move from one classroom to another to teach, as opposed to having a dedicated classroom to themselves. Portables aren't easy to come by, Lee said, noting that space is not always convenient. Is it in a playground, or would it take us up a parking lot space? Lee said portable classrooms are also more expensive than the public realizes. It's not so much that these lease payments of $1,000 a month cost a lot. It's the site work and electrical and concrete, and then to get technology out there, he said, noting that the work is all done at prevailing wage. We have the safest portables I've ever seen. When I've been principal, we just plop them outside. The first one at the junior high was $100,000 to prep. The portable classrooms are not equipped with bathrooms. One board member asked about the feasibility of porta-potties. Another said junior high students using class time to go from the portables to the main building on restroom breaks is a problem because there aren't enough facilities. One board member said he would be more inclined to put portables on site that require less prep work, such as parking lots. If it means parking in the streets, the people have voted, he said. The also broached possibly eliminating some or all sports and using existing facilities, including playing and practice fields. No board members favored any elimination of sports, but sports fields could easily accommodate portable classrooms. Lee said one wrinkle, as enrollment figures are studied, is an influx of special needs students. Generally, more equipment and more staff are needed to accommodate those students. Also considered, moving administrative offices out of Middletown Prairie Elementary and converting that area into classroom space. Board President Sonny McMurray said perhaps another grade level could be brought into that building. The building has the most square footage, she said, noting perhaps half of the third grade classes could be there and half at Lincoln Trail. Maybe we end up in a portable, Lee said, of the administrative offices. One board member said Middletown Prairie, which houses pre-kindergarten through second grade, has the largest classroom sizes with the smallest students, and perhaps it would be wiser to divide those classrooms in half rather than doing so at the junior high school. And we're going to take a break now with our part one of the News Gazette, and I will be back in a short moment. Thank you.